Good morning, my friends.
Good morning.
It's nice to see each of you. Got a question to start out. How has the last 15 years been to you in the ecclesia? 20? How far back you got to go? You know, we've all been through the same situation. We've been through it together, maybe separately at different times. I look out here, I see a lot of faces that if it was in a battlefield of a real battlefield, they'd be called battle worn, wouldn't they? There's a lot of hardened, battle hardened soldiers of Christ here that have seen a lot of things and had to endure a lot of things. And I think it's important for us to, we're going to consider some of the things that we've been through, where we've been, and where we're going as a community this morning, I hope. I'm confident that all of you, at least I hope, otherwise none of this will make any sense. Hopefully all of you have seen at one time or another a chain of dominoes falling down progressively. Physically speaking, the energy required or the force required to topple each successive domino is less than what the falling or toppling domino exerts when it falls. And they've done calculations and things of that nature, and the energy that each falling domino exerts is sufficient to topple a neighbor that is 1.5 times its size. So that means that as the first one falls, the fate of the last one is secured upon the fall of the first. Whether there's 5 or 6 or whatever's in this picture, whether there's 5 or there's 5,000 or 50,000 dominoes in the chain, apart from some interference along the line, the fate of the last one is secured, it's falling, upon the fall of the first one. Now, with the knowledge of this, the ability to grow in size 1.5 times, or for each domino to topple one and a half size, its own 1.5 times its own size. This experiment was conducted, so I thought this was interesting. Now that the first tile that fell there, it was less than 1/4 inch tall and 0.04 inch thick. And the final one that fell was 3.5 feet tall and weighed about 100 pounds. Had the experiment continued at this rate, the man there that organized it said that with only 16 more tiles, the final one that fell would have been as tall as the Empire State Building. Maybe somebody, I don't know what that is, but that's probably big. The final one would have been as tall as the Empire State Building. So over the course of only 29 blocks, which would have been the total there, the first one 1/4 inch tall, 29 blocks later, the last one as tall as the Empire State Building. And the energy just in this little experiment from that, the fall of that first one was amplified over 2 billion times from the fall of that first 1/4 inch tall tile. Thinking about the power that ultimately was contained in that 1/4 inch tile, I'm reminded of James, the 3rd chapter, in this passage we're all familiar with. And I'm terribly sorry. Never mind. Somebody's got me covered.
Is that a fresh one?
It was unopened. Yeah. James 3, verse 3. We're told here, "Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths, that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold also the ships, which though they be great and are driven of fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. Even so the tongue is a little member, and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. So, we see what a large impact a seemingly insignificant thing can have, be it this small quarter inch tall tile, the bit in the mouth of such a powerful animal as a horse, or the rudder on the ship. And I think one of the important lessons here is that we should never underestimate or undervalue the impact of our decisions upon our lives and the lives of others, our actions, and our words, obviously, as is specifically being spoken of here in James. Now, we're obviously concerned with the spiritual and social implications of this demonstration. We're not here to talk about physics this morning. You may well be aware, more so than I, that three U.S. presidents used what's called the domino theory to justify and prolong the Vietnam War. Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson all referred to this domino theory out of fear that if one nation fell to communism, then the rest of them in the area would topple to it, because it's such a wonderful thing, I guess. More recently, this principle has been observed in Northern Africa, I believe, where over the last decade we've seen the fall of Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt to what the world calls democracy, and observation would call it anarchy. So from these few brief examples, we can see the reality of this domino effect upon social groups. Now, what I would like to suggest this morning is that this effect is not limited to the world, but the ecclesia is suspect to it as well. The energy that topples people, however, is not weight or gravity, as it is in these experiments. It is influence, I believe. And as we said, Christadelphians are susceptible to these principles of the domino effect, the social effects of it, as anyone in the world. And therefore, as Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 10, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. And I don't think we have to look too far back in history to recognize this is entirely a possibility. So, we're battered daily with these blows upon us, trying to knock us over from the world without. We've got the sin nature, sin in the flesh within us, a natural tendency to fall or to transgress, to cross over from divine law. And then we have influences which more than likely, technically they should be, stronger upon us than the influences of the world without. And we've got those within the ecclesia itself, among the Christadelphian body, these influences knocking against us. These personal influences, social influences, and we're moving now more directly towards within the ecclesial environment, increase in strength as they grow closer in social proximity. Okay? The closer it gets to us, the more influence a person has. What do we mean by that? We react and handle a situation within our own ecclesia or within our own family if false doctrine or immorality arises. We handle that situation entirely differently than when it comes up in Colorado or California or wherever. We deal with it. It has a different impact upon us when it's closer. That's obvious from observation. When we add on top of this the tendency of the flesh towards transgression, towards falling, as Paul warns us, take heed lest we fall, we have a very grave situation that we have to be prepared for. So we're going to focus upon these ecclesial influences for the next little while. Over the last 15 and or 20 years, and some of you would go back even further, I recognize, and I wouldn't argue with you, we have observed the fall of brethren and ecclesias to the influences of the apostasy or immorality, false doctrine, whether it be of the fundamental nature or of the moral doctrines that we hold. We've observed the fall of brethren and ecclesias of increasing stature and apparent stability, haven't we, to the appeals of false doctrine and immorality. Now, as with Amalek, when they preyed upon Israel, as they were coming out of Egypt, who did they first take off? The stragglers, the weak. Those were the first ones to fall, even in our time, weren't they? That's the obvious first victims of this. I don't like to say victims, but they're the first ones to fall. First to fall were perhaps not a real surprise to us. 20 years ago, we're thinking 1998. They're kicking off with the NASA at that time. And some of them thought it was a good idea. And the ones that thought it was a good idea in 1998, we weren't real surprised about that. But as time has gone on, we've seen what we consider to be more stable. Things that surprised us from time to time. And it suggests to us that all of us are susceptible to these influences the longer time goes on and the closer they grow to us. So I want to look over at Colossians 2 here, because I think we've got some information about how we can increase our stability and be prepared to withstand these blows or these influences. In Colossians 2, verse 6, we're told, "As ye have therefore received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk ye in Him, rooted and built up in Him, and established in the faith, as ye have been taught, abounding therein with thanksgiving." That's an important theme also throughout the Scripture and hopefully throughout our class this morning. Abounding with thanksgiving and the importance of gratitude and thanksgiving towards God for His provisions. "Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world and not after Christ." So the question is then, obviously, as these time goes on, how is it that we avoid falling in this cascade of dominoes as they topple towards us, or tiles? And what time does this class, do we stop? I forgot to look at my book before I came up here, I'm sorry. Five after? Great. Okay, how do we avoid falling in the cascade to these negative influences of false doctrine or immorality? Well, this is one way. One option is separation. This isolates us from the cascade of toppling or falling dominoes. This is the other option. As you can see, Elijah saw what I was doing in there, and he had to come in and help when he saw what fun was going on there. So he wanted to push him over this time. This is the other option. You can separate and isolate yourself from it, or, as is demonstrated here, you can unite, unity. Have to be bound together closely and strongly enough so that the mass upon which those dominoes are falling is larger than it can knock over. Here, as we can see, the three have united in such a way that they can't. They were united by superglue to make that work. Now, let's think about some of the positive and negative implications of each of these options, separation or unity. When we look at separation as an option, it only eliminates the possibility of impact from one direction. And as we discussed from the start, we've got things coming at us from every direction. You can only isolate yourself so far from these influences. Eventually, they're getting to you from one direction or another. And if we're looking at things from a very practical nature or from a very practical perspective, the community, the remnant with which we associate this community, in reality, is not interested in a group effort to unite under a new series of documents and create a formal inter-ecclesial separation from the unamended community at large. There's not real support for that presently. So, that's the way things stand right now. If we look at unity, however, I want to look over at Ecclesiastes. You're familiar with this. Ecclesiastes 4, verse 9. Very important little piece of wisdom here from Solomon, I believe. Ecclesiastes 4, verse 9. There is one alone, and there is not a second. Yea, he hath neither child nor brother. Yet is there no end of all his labor. Neither is his eye satisfied with riches. Neither saith he, for whom do I labor and bereave my soul of good? This is also vanity. Yea, it is sore travail. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. Again, if two lie together, then they have heat. But how can one be warm alone? And if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly or easily broken. So here I think I'm using this as evidence of the importance of this unity and the strength that can be derived from it. We can help ourselves and each other withstand the impacts of these influences by uniting closely enough with a bond that is strong enough with enough of our brethren. And I really think that's my suggestion this morning. And that's pretty much what you're going to hear about for the next 2.5 hours. The byproduct, however, of unifying is the natural development of a separation, isn't it? So really, if you focus on the one, you get both. Because if you take these dominoes, if you've got a line of them, and you start squeezing them together, what happens? Amongst that group that's united over here, there's a separation from the ones that didn't squeeze together and join with the others. So the byproduct is the same. The outcome is the same. It's just how you accomplish it in the first place. We've observed this, haven't we? There has developed, to the degree that we have, as a remnant community, united around a certain set of principles, a separation has naturally developed organically between ourselves and the rest of Christadelphia that has not united around those same principles. I think that we've seen that. It's not documented. It's not all written out on paper so that we can go and read about how we did it. But it's happened. And really, the reality is more the concern. It's more my concern, and I think it's more important before the Lord than how well we document it. Now, I know that I'm well aware that some brethren are very strong proponents of a documented intra-ecclesial separation from the community, larger Christadelphian community or Unimenic community. I understand that. And at one time I was in full agreement and a proponent of that. And now I'm not. However, if we disagree on this, what I'm trying to emphasize is that we end up with the same thing. We end up with a nice, strong community if we would go about the work without the paperwork, as if we tried to document it and went through those steps. What we hope to demonstrate is that if we get upset with each other and we refuse to unite with one another because I say the documentation and the paperwork isn't as important as what we actually do, and you want to have the paperwork and then worry about the actual activity, if we don't unite because we disagree on that technicality, you're leaving yourself and you're leaving me and the rest of us that you refuse to unite with over that technicality vulnerable to these impacts. So we need to set aside some of these non-fundamental differences, I believe. The Lord plainly declared, if a house be divided against itself, it cannot stand. Now why? Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. So, how do we unite then? If we're going to, well, we are. We're going to focus on unity, strengthening these bonds. How is it that we can unite? As I see it, there's two options. You can unite against something. You can rally people together against things in a defensive position. Or you can unite for something upon a common basis in an offensive position. And I want you to keep those things plain in your mind. For and against. Are we uniting for something or against something? And the difference in that is being on the offensive and the defensive in our spiritual and ecclesial, not only mindset, but activity. Uniting for a common cause, just like unity is distinguished from this separation as options for isolating from the falling cascade. Unity accomplishes both. Uniting for a common cause, going on the offensive accomplishes both as well. When people unite in support of a common set of principles, they are naturally united against the things opposed to those principles. That's why, in our statement of faith, the fables to be refused naturally follows the statement of faith. The positive declaration aspect of it. One can be opposed, and this is an important fact. A person can be opposed to the same things that you oppose while not supporting the same things that you support. There's lots of people that are opposed to Catholicism and the papacy in the world, but they don't understand or believe in the Abrahamic promises any more than the Catholics do. So that we start running into issues when our unity is based upon a defensive or a mutually defensive position. Jehovah's Witnesses would readily unite with us to protest against the immortality of the soul and the reward upon death. But they don't understand the kingdom of God any better than anybody else. They worship weekly in a kingdom hall. They think their church is the kingdom. It's the same as the Catholics and everybody else, Church of Christ. I'm going to suggest now that not only should we unite, but we should unite in this offensive position, uniting upon common principles for a common purpose. I want to turn over to Genesis 16 because I think there's an excellent example here of the point I'm trying to make. Genesis 16. Verse 7, we read, And the angel of Yahweh found her. This is Hagar. She's fled from Sarai. The angel of Yahweh found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain in the way to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence camest thou, and whither wilt thou go?" And she said, "I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai." Now, the angel asked two questions. Where are you coming from, and where are you going? Which one did Hagar answer? Hagar only knew what she wanted to get away from. She only knew what she wanted to separate from. She was just trying to escape the situation, the unfair, as she perceived it, treatment that she was receiving at the hand of Sarai. Do we have any better answer if we were to be asked this? Where are you coming from, and where are you going? What are you trying to get away from, and what are you trying to get to? Do we know where we're going? Or are we just concerned about getting away from these problems? I think we need to have an answer to both of these questions. Hagar did not have an answer, and what was she told? Go back to Sarai. Where have we come from? Where are we going? Now, okay, unity is better than to pursue unity is better than to pursue separation, is the premise that I've set here. To pursue unity based upon an offensive, supportive of common principles position instead of unity based upon a defensive position rejecting things. We've said as a premise. Now, there's still difficulties, aren't there? It's not as easy as just let's unite around these common principles and it's done. It's not that simple. But there's more problems also, I believe, with this defensive position. If all that unites us is opposition to certain false doctrines as they rise up and immorality, as important as it is to oppose those things, I'm not minimizing that, but we've got to have more to our unity than opposing these things. See, what happens is when one enemy is defeated, if our basis of unity is mutual defense, what do we have to find? We got to find another enemy to hold ourselves together. And so we go from enemy to enemy to enemy just to keep some sense of community about ourselves. If we don't have something to fight against, we don't have anything to unite us. What happens when I find the next issue that we've got to go fight against? And John Manson doesn't show up for the battle. Well, then I start to wonder, where's John? Why didn't he show up? Has he left us now? Why isn't he fighting this battle? The problems start to develop when someone doesn't join us on our chosen mountain. While I may agree with you as it regards the principles in question on this particular issue, maybe I don't think that particular issue is a problem for me. Or maybe John doesn't think my problem is his problem. While agreeing with the principles in question, maybe he doesn't think the front on which it is raised is important to address. Maybe he or I are simply busy working on some other thing in support of the truth somewhere, and doesn't have time to get tangled up in this also. All these things are possibilities. But when our unity is based upon this defensive position, uniting to oppose enemies, then when someone doesn't show up, there develops this problem. So if our, and we become suspicious, we might say, about why that person doesn't see this issue to be as critical as I do. However, if we're united in this offensive, as I'm suggesting, if we unite in this offensive or positive sense in mutual support of a common cause, no such concerns arise, do they? When an issue arises and John doesn't bother showing up, I don't assume there's a problem. I assume he's busy working on something else in support of that cause that I'm working for, in support of that truth, in support of those doctrines and that remnant. I don't think he's left me because he won't join me on this particular battlefield. I know he's working in his own area of influence on something different. I'm going to give an example. Skip part of this and give an example. This one's fresh. I hope I don't step on any toes. For example, it recently came to my attention that a magazine called The Bible Magazine basically abandoned what they had taught concerning Latter-day prophecy for the last however long it's been in publication, I don't know. And they had changed virtually over to what we would call an Arab-centric viewpoint. Is that a relatively accurate description of it, Brother Al?
No. I would say they
have... Has to do with the destruction of Israel?
Right.
Okay. Has to do with not the Arabs as much as it does with the preservation of Israel, and that they won't face any destruction in the latter days at the hand of Gog. Okay, well, so we've got this issue then, a failure to recognize what Zechariah and Ezekiel and all the prophets are pretty clear about, and something that this magazine had taught in harmony with Brother Thomas and the Pioneer Brethren and Christadelphian teaching throughout their existence. Now, I received 3 trial issues of the Bible Magazine about 10 years ago. I didn't ever subscribe to it. I wasn't that impressed personally. It was a little bit Zionistic in my opinion. Reminded me of John Hagee personally. They had an article, an exposition of sin in there. It's a central, amended, produced magazine. I didn't agree with what they had to say about sin. I didn't subscribe. So when this came out, as you can see, I didn't know. I didn't even know what the issue was until somebody called and asked if I'd heard about it. Well, I hadn't heard about it. It's not on my radar. I frankly don't care what the Bible Magazine says any more than the Christadelphian Magazine. And at this point, I don't even know what's written in the Advocate Magazine. Christadelphian Advocate, not the one in the world. So, if somebody comes to me and wants me to get on board with an opposition to what the Bible Magazine wrote, I agree 100% in principle that what they taught was wrong. And I support those principles. And I teach them within my sphere of influence. But I'm not going to spend much time trying to convince the editors of the Bible Magazine that they're wrong. I just don't, I've never associated with that community, and it's irrelevant to me personally. But I support the principles that those who want to confront that support. We're still united, but I'm not going to join you on that battlefield. You see? But our unity is not interfered with if we're united based upon this positive and offensive position. You can fight that battle with the people that are going to fight that battle while I fight and work to support those same principles in a different way, in a different part of the community. So when I don't show up, it's not because I don't think that's irrelevant or those principles don't matter or I don't agree with the people that fight that battle. I do agree with them and I do support those principles. But I've got issues in the Clinton ecclesia to deal with. I've got two kids to raise. Other people have six kids to raise. Be careful when somebody doesn't show up, that we don't assume that there's an issue just because they didn't show up to that battle. We can support the same principles while not fighting every single issue with one another. Now, in reality, in this united sense, in this positive offensive position, this type of unity produces a stronger and a better unity and a stronger body. Because I can't be in all places at all times, and neither can anybody else. But each individual can support the truth within their own sphere of influence. That is, among that portion of the flock with which they associate on a regular basis. I believe it's in Proverbs that we're told to know the face of your flock. And there's some aspect of that is very relevant in the natural things. He says, because the riches don't last forever. You have to take care of things and be a good steward if you want to preserve them. But the primary teaching there, I believe, is in reference to the ecclesia. Know the face or the state or the condition of your flock, that with which you are in regular association. We should be able to see in the faces and recognize in the spirit or the demeanor of the members of our ecclesia when something's wrong. And we should be reaching out and helping them in that sense. Know the face of the flock and work within that area that we have the most influence. So, back to the angel's question to Hagar. Where did you come from and where are you going? Whence camest thou and whither wilt thou go? As I said, I'm not trying to minimize the importance of earnestly contending for the faith. There is no question in my mind about the importance of an earnest contention for the faith once delivered unto the saints. However, I'm suggesting by what I'm saying here is that we need to have more than opposing principles to unite us. We need to be united in support of common principles. The opposition will come naturally. Okay, so we unite around common principles is the premise. We go on this offensive type of position as opposed to the defensive. There's still problems. And here's one of them. You heard the story about the cat that jumps on a hot stove. They say the cat that jumps on a hot stove won't jump on the hot stove again. But he won't jump on a cold stove either, will he? He just thinks he's going to get burned. He's staying away from that stove. I believe that through these past 15 years, 20 years, or however long you want to define it, there has been extreme difficulty on all of the ecclesias and all of the brethren. Nobody has been excused from these trials that we faced. If we're being honest with ourselves, and I think that that's critical in order to move forward with this unity, if we're being honest, even among this small remnant, there are residual hard feelings, distrust, suspicions, and emotional exhaustion. Some of us lost very good friends. Some of us lost family. Some of us lost lifelong friends, what we might even call a best friend. We've lost members of our ecclesias. Some of us have had to depart from the ecclesias in which we grew up or with which we have been associated for our entire lives. Now bear with me in this. I would suggest that among this remnant that has endured through these things, we have some emotionally scarred people. But we don't like to talk about that, do we? We don't want to talk about emotional scars or pains or difficulties. But the emotional toll, or if you want to call it the spiritual toll, I don't care. Whatever you want to call it to get comfortable with it. If we neglect the reality of this, we're doing a disservice to ourselves and the people that we're associating with. The things that we've endured, the battles that we've had to fight, the things that we've witnessed, take an emotional toll on people, as well as the exhaustion that comes with it. I think we need to accept this and deal with it. In some cases, there is residual resentment toward one another. Perhaps I think you did or didn't do something in your particular situation that would have prevented the loss of one of my dear friends. Maybe you think I did that. In this way, we end up blaming those who remain with us, united on these common principles. We end up blaming those who remain for driving away those who have departed. Those who departed are the ones with whom the ones that we really liked, the ones we had a rapport with, we had a nice history with, we enjoyed getting together and spending time with them. And now you're left with me and John. We end up blaming those who remain for driving away those who have departed. I understand. I believe that this is part of the reason we hear expressions of a desire. Every time we turn around, we need more communication, somebody says. We need to communicate more. A lot of people want it, but we don't see too much of it actually happen. Until some issue comes up that we want to fight against. We hear expressions of a desire for increased communication among this remnant, but we don't see any actual increase in that communication. To some extent, I think we're afraid to get close to someone only to have them leave us again, or perhaps we don't want to get close to people that we blame for driving away the ones that we liked. So we end up waiting around and longing for the good old days, those deceptive good old days. And we neglect the cultivation of new relationships in the ecclesia with the ones that are actually here. And that's a disservice, brethren. It's a disservice to this remnant of believers to let this buffer remain between all of us. We neglect developing new friendships and new relationships. We slowly weaken and decay the body, and we leave ourselves and this remnant vulnerable to impact. Ecclesiastes 7 tells us, "Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this." It serves no purpose to wonder about those good old days. Why were they better? All these things are realities, I believe. And I'm afraid if we don't see them, we need to look a little closer. However, these things can be overcome. They can be set aside. The hard feelings, the resentment, the distrust, we can put that away. All it is a thought and a feeling within us. The same way that we acquired it, we can set it aside. And I don't know how else, as a community, we're going to move on without doing so, without acknowledging these things for the realities that they are, setting them aside, and moving ahead in unity. I'm suggesting, then, that today, in 2018, the primary problem that we as a remnant face is not whatever's going on, whatever the latest thing in the unamended community general. I don't think that's our main problem. And I don't think that whatever's going on in the central community or the Bereans or whatever other Christadelphian community out there, I don't think that whatever's happening out there is our primary problem. I think that our primary problem right now is the disjointed character of our little community, this little remnant. And the good thing about that is we're not dependent upon any of those other things to solve that problem. Because the solution, if the problem is in here, then the solution is in here with us as well. And I'm saying in here, but anybody that associates with us that's unable to be here this weekend. The solution to our primary problem is within the remnant. The problem is not some other community. It is our own selves. Specifically, our lack of attention, I believe, to nurturing and building up this fragile young community through interaction, cooperation, communication. And we get back to what we read in Colossians, gratitude for what we have instead of wishing for what was then. So, moving forward then. God has seen fit to preserve a remnant of brethren out of the ecclesias in New Mexico, out of the ecclesia in Denver, out of the ecclesias in Ontario, out of the ecclesias in Richmond, those in Kentucky, those in Arlington, those in Texas, those in North Little Rock, those in St. Louis, and perhaps other places that I've forgotten to mention. God has preserved a remnant out of all these places. They've united upon certain principles and against other principles, just like you, just like me. And here in Orlando, He has preserved, through these many years of trials, a remnant of brethren, though it has not been without heartbreaking loss, as we've already discussed. 1 Corinthians 11, we're told, there must be also heresies among you, that they which are approved may be made manifest or revealed among you. This is the purpose of these heresies, these divisions, these trials, to reveal the approved, that they might be manifest. And John adds to this, 1 John 2, he says, they went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would no doubt have continued with us. But they went out that they might be made manifest that they were not all of us. So these trials, these heresies, these difficulties, whatever we relate these things to, they manifest both the approved and those that are not among us, I'll say. It reveals things. That's the purpose of trial, to separate the gold, the wheat and the chaff, to purify. I want you to think about something. In fact, this is not even, when I was thinking about this, I had forgotten about this. Sister Suzanne, just 3 months ago, she rode down here with us from Louisiana. Sister Suzanne had a life-saving surgery, didn't you, on your heart. She had a life-preserving surgery performed. Very difficult. Doctors didn't even know if they could do it. They cut her open. And now, 3 months later, she's able to be here, traveling relatively well. She wasn't much trouble at all for us. She had a life-preserving surgery performed on her. And now she's got a scar, don't you? Big one. Would you complain about the scar if what was done that created that scar saved your life? Think about Israel in the wilderness. They'd been delivered from Egypt by the miraculous hand of God. Something impossible had been accomplished before their eyes. I'm not going to read all the passages. You're familiar with it. But Israel complained after they had been delivered from Egypt that God had brought them into the wilderness, and Moses had brought them into the wilderness to be killed with thirst in the desert. And then they complained that, in fact, perhaps they were mistaken. They brought them out there to kill them with hunger. And then after food is provided, they complained about the food that had been provided. Complaining, and we know that was not pleasing to God. They were complaining about the scar after the surgery that had delivered them from certain destruction and elimination from the earth at the hand of the Egyptians. Gratitude and thankfulness is always valuable. Complaining and murmuring, discontent with what we've got, is never valuable. We should appreciate what God has preserved for our benefit and for His glory. And that is this remnant community with which we associate. So a foundation has been laid. By forces beyond our control, the unamended community was cast into turmoil. And that state has been maintained for 15 to 20 years, depending on how you count. Some of you may say 40. I believe that we've arrived at somewhat of a closure, finally, and much to the relief of everyone. And I'm not just talking about people within our group. It's a relief to those with whom we've contended also. Don't be confused. They're satisfied to move on, too. But what do we do now? Because this is, we're the ones that have to rebuild now, this remnant community. We had to leave what was established and start with something new. We've been occupied with defensive measures on behalf of the truth for the past 15 to 20 years. Now that a remnant exists for all intents and purposes as a distinct community from the mainstream unamended community, what do we do with it? Their myriad problems should not be the concern to us that they once were. Under the Mosaic law, once a priest had determined that a house contained a fretting leprosy, he had it demolished. Did he go back to inspect it anymore? No. It was demolished. The leprosy consumed it. It was over. What will we do with the time previously occupied with combating the various errors among the unamended community that we had to deal with as they were thrust upon us? I don't think that we need to go back and inspect the house anymore. It had a fretting leprosy, and from a spiritual standpoint, we had to walk away from it. The decision was made. Now it's time to move on and do something else instead of inspecting that house. A foundation has been laid over recent years with the development of this small remnant out of the mainstream unamended community, but there is much work left to be done. So, we will pick up with our next class. I believe it's time. Thank you.